Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York, partnering with Grow NYC to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets. For more information, visit christmastreesny.org.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to Redig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are collectively Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area, and our show brings the culture to horticulture. So today's show is the fourth and final part of our series called Politics of Place. And during this series, we have shared many stories with you over the past 6 weeks, from immigrants and their impacts on American cuisine, stories about local activists using seed bombs to launch a green movement, philanthropists and garden lovers building powerful institutions dedicated to preserving important gardens and landscapes throughout the United States.
Yeah.
But today, we come back to home base, to New York City, and to an individual who has done so much to help preserve green space in New York City. She is one of the reasons Central Park is the glorious place it is today. We have in the studio with us today Betsy Barlow Rogers, and she has just written a new book that documents and puts into natural and historical context the unique parks and green spaces that make our city livable. Her book is called Green Metropolis, The Extraordinary Landscapes of New York City as Nature, History, and Design, published by Alfred E. Knopf. Betsy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Alice,
yeah.
Why don't you read a little bit about Betsy's very brief bio.
It is, right. So this is the smallest bio for somebody so important.
It's very small.
Elizabeth Barlow Rogers is the president of the Foundation for Landscape Studies and the author of 8 previous books about the design of cities, parks, and gardens as expressions of place. She has long been involved in historic landscape preservation and was the first person to hold the title of Central Park Administrator, a position that was created in 1979. In 1980, she was instrumental in founding the Central Park Conservancy, a public-private partnership supporting the restoration and management of the park. She served in both positions until 1996. A native of San Antonio, Texas, she has made New York her home since 1964. So she has seen a lot of political changes and growth in the city. Some of it not so nice, and others of it amazing.
Yes. And now that is a bio that's the back of a book jacket, okay?
Right.
Now I want to read what Tony Hiss said in the foreword of the book, which I think shows the other side. This is what he says about Betsy Barlow Rogers. Among her many exceptional talents, Betsy Barlow Rogers, who a generation ago organized Central Park's rescue when it was at the point of collapse, is an urban trailblazer, a pusher of the envelope, a seer into the beyond, who compiles compelling, meticulously, and joyfully observed "Won't You Join Me" updates from a landscape whose very existence she helped reveal. The deep countryside still spread out across all 5 boroughs of densely settled New York City. And I think that says it much more eloquently.
And that's really what we're going to focus on today is not Central Park, so to speak.
Yes.
Because that's its own story. But the other landscapes and the shorelines and the wetlands and the forests that make up the boundaries of this urban place where we all live.
Yeah. And you start in chapter one, Betsy, with a really great couple of sentences. Here's what you say about the birth of a landscape. Long before the city became real estate, divided and occupied in accordance with political and economic dictates, long before it became imprinted with human occupation, in fact, long before the human species even existed, there were the land and the sea.
Yeah.
And just as the New York of real estate and urban planning is dynamic, a city constantly erasing and rebuilding itself, the New York of bedrock, sand, and water is forever altering itself as well, responding to the forces of geology and climate. So we go way back.
Yes.
So
those are big existential thoughts. Yes.
So, Betsy, can you describe, of course, briefly, if possible, the sort of natural forces that shape New York and what it looked like when the first Europeans landed here over 400 years ago?
Well, understanding New York gets you into geology.
Right.
My geology knowledge is not extensive. It's very local, but I'm fascinated with geological New York, because when you think of this great womb-shaped harbor, when you think of the hills on Staten Island or running down the spine of Long Island, when you think of the wonderfully polished rocks in Central Park, you then begin to learn that those rocks were polished by a glacier moving over them between 20,000 and 10,000 years ago. But they, in turn, are the eroded stumps of an ancient mountain range. When you see those hills on Staten Island I just mentioned, that is the terminal moraine of the last glacier.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this is how the city is configured. It's responsible for its topography, its geography. And so human habitation, which is due to that great harbor and to, of course, a good climate, and other factors, made this ideal location for a great metropolis. And what we don't realize, many people don't, is how it's a great metropolis, but it's still a green metropolis.
Mm-hmm. So let's jump right in and talk about some of these New York gems. Let's talk about Jamaica Bay and the Greenway. Do you want to start there, or should we start in Staten Island?
No, wherever. There's just so much to talk about. Jamaica Bay is one of my favorite places, as we were discussing earlier, and everybody sees it who comes in from JFK.
Right.
Right? You see all the marshland.
You go over the ocean. You see the Atlantic Ocean, and then all of a sudden, there is this fortitude of land, you know, and marsh.
It's blue and green when you come down. And what was interesting, you tell a lot of stories, you include a lot of interesting people in the book. And one of the things that I found most interesting about Jamaica Bay was that the birding aspect of it, the plants that attract birds, that was completely man-made, right? And it was made kind of almost single-handedly, right, Betsy, by a gardener. So tell us about that person and how he created this sanctuary that seems so natural now.
That story was told actually in my first book, which is called The Forests and Wetlands of New York City. And you can think of Green Metropolis as my return to the sites that I discussed in that earlier book. And some of the cast of characters have changed. Now, the protagonists, let's call them, in this book are my current gurus and the real habitués of these places that I hung out with. But back then, there was a Parks Department employee named Herbert Johnson who was given a house out on the, let's say, what is it? Robert Moses was responsible for doing one really great thing besides trying to build all those highways and destroy green spaces. Green New York. He had a huge fight with the Department of Sanitation, and being the power player that he was, he won. And so instead of dumping garbage on Jamaica Bay like all the other marshlands. Mm-hmm. In this case, he was able to build a wildlife refuge. Mm-hmm. And it is really a case of build it and they will come. The birds, all these wonderful shorebirds, and even some raptors like the osprey that I talk about.
Yes.
All of this comeback was a remarkable thing. And what Moses did was put a Parks Department gardener. In those days, they had really professional gardeners because after the Depression, a lot of the estate gardeners from
Hudson
River
from Long
Valley
Island
and out on Long Island, those gardeners got jobs in the Park Department. So Herbert Johnson was, you know, Park Department gardener, you know, just given the place to live, house out on in the newly made wildlife refuge, which was just, you know, sandbars really, with dredged lake, you know, West Pond and East Pond. And so what did he do? He got beech grasses. He disced in all these beech grasses. He got seeds from the black pines on the Rockaway in Jacob Riis Park. He propagated those. He planted those. He did a lot of planting and plants, of course, that would attract birds. So now it's one of the major bird watching places, certainly on the North Atlantic Flyway. And people come from all over.
Right, because it really is a stopover. It's a place of refuge for that, you know, that trail, that subway line, so to speak, down south.
Airway line
down south.
And you know, of course, they put an airport right there.
Which is a whole other discussion.
So it is a beautiful place. If those of you who haven't been there, it's a great, it has trails, and I think you can kayak in the marshes, and they have ranger talks, and it's really, you don't feel like you're in New York City when you're there. It's quite amazing. Well, staying with the Robert Moses, so that was, he redeemed himself a little bit with that, But he was involved in some other activities that weren't so positive for the environment. Let's go to Staten Island and talk about the Greenbelt. That's a place that's very close to my heart. I spent some of my formative years in Staten Island, and I'm familiar with some of the Greenbelt, but I learned so much from your book about it. Tell us about how that particular bit of New York green space was preserved in spite of Moses' efforts.
Well, that's a story we started talking about earlier, and it goes back to my life as a young conservationist marching with a group that were determined to save the Greenbelt from, this is the central spine of Long Island, all high and forested woodland and ridge.
Uh-huh.
And Moses was planning to build a highway that would connect from New Jersey over to Long Island. The Verrazano Bridge, of course, was, you know, yet to come. And had just been built.
Yeah.
Yeah.
64?
Yes, it was 64.
Yeah, 64. You're right. And I came to New York in 64. So this was in 65, 66, 67 in there. And we were protesting building a highway through what was the most wonderful forested upland mm-hmm. with an old Girl Scout camp, which is now High Rock Nature Center. So that was a real early victory for conservation in New York City, and the beginning, actually, of the decline of Moses's power, that he had such an iron grip on all city planning for so long. And
yeah.
this was, we felt a very great
victory. He liked sports, Betsy. He liked sports, right? He liked building basketball hoops and, you know, boardwalks. And his philosophy was very different from how we think about using green space now and the fringes of, you know, waterways.
Well, he was about the built environment versus the non-built environment.
Not exactly.
No?
Not exactly.
Okay.
No. Here, you have to look at cultural eras.
Right.
And the first era of park building, of course, does begin with Central Park. And scenic recreation is the ideal. You're to go on the carriage drives, or you're riding on the bridle trail on horseback, right. or you're going on the beautiful pedestrian pathways through meadows and woodland. And that kind of recreation, by the beginning of the 20th century, people are starting to want active play. Mm-hmm. And the reformers who were bringing immigrant New Yorkers into the general cultural mainstream, all of this is going on. So recreation is becoming popular.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's Moses, however, who wants to, has a plan right the minute he becomes park commissioner in 1934 to build recreation facilities. So it's not building structures per se, although there are lots
yes.
of bathhouses and community
right.
centers and,
yeah. right.
and, you know, all of those
tennis
kinds
house.
Of structures.
Right,
the
right.
tennis house, sure.
Right, the picnic
but
house. Right.
The actual layering of the landscape with recreation and beaches. You mentioned he was mm-hmm. interested in sports. He was a swimmer.
Yes.
He was a swimmer at Yale, and he loved the beach. He went, you know, he lived, what was his place on Long Island? Anyway, he would go in the ocean swimming. And so all these beaches mm-hmm. of New York are important. So then mm-hmm. the swimming pools and the basketball courts, the community centers, the ball fields, all of this is what he wanted. And so it was, you know, Olmsted be damned, you know, the original,
the
move over.
Yeah.
Central Park is just so much open space to make, you know, recreation facilities.
Uh-huh.
So that scenic recreation ideal, it goes out, and active recreation comes in.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean that New York lost its greenness. In fact, it probably gained because he was such a, you know, park builder.
Right.
It just was a different kind of green.
And I do, okay. you know, I do appreciate the beaches that he
oh, he's
created.
Built fabulous
I mean,
beaches.
He's
and he preserved all that land
that's right.
along Long Island. And if it wasn't for that, man, there'd just be condos.
That's so true.
Yeah. All the way.
I agree with that.
And those are the best beaches. I mean,
in the world, the great Atlantic all the way out to Montauk Point.
It is
those be from Breezy Point to Montauk Point.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very true. And I'll tell you, I have family who, you know, there's plenty of beaches in Italy. Italy has an entire, quite a long coastline. And even though I've gone there and been in the Mediterranean, there's nothing like New York's
sandy beaches.
Yeah, you know, it's really, really special. Now, the other, we talked a little bit about topography and geology. In reading your book, I learned about the northern part of New York City that I didn't know too much about, Inwood.
Right. Yes. New York Schist.
The Schist. And that was really, really interesting because that has a very different feel to it and a different geology than, you know, the southern part. Let's talk about Inwood Hill Park.
Well, Inwood is a forest, really. Yeah. Yeah. And Inwood is Inwood Hill. And it, as I talk about it in the book, has an interesting history. During the Revolutionary War, there was an encampment of the mercenary soldiers called Hessians. And mm-hmm. So it has artifacts, from that. It had Native American artifacts. And, the author of the book, Manhattan, mm-hmm. writes about along the shore, you could find the shells, oyster shells and things like that, that had been left by the Native mm-hmm. Americans that mm-hmm. encamped there. So anyway, it has a very interesting history. And then over time, it became a place where there were some summer estates. The wood that had all been cut down during the Revolutionary War for firewood, then states plant trees. And so landscapes are always transforming and changing. But basically, it became, again, a forested, a wonderful, beautiful forested woodland with a few of these exotic trees that were left from the era in which there were some nice summer estates there. And right. it overlooks the Hudson.
Right.
And it's the place in New York where I really love, if I want to take an in-city hike mm-hmm. and not go up to Bear Mountain or go further afield, you just take the A train to Inwood Hill.
I love it.
I just love the A train because
you can get from
Arlen
to the Battery. Yeah.
You bet. No, you can get to the Rockaways.
Yeah.
You can get
right.
from Inwood is the northern terminus, uh-huh. and Rockaways are the southern
final.
Terminus,
yeah.
and you get off in Broad Channel, and there you are at Jamaica Bay Wildlife Refuge. So just take the A train or any of the other subway lines, because everything in this book is subway accessible.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the A train, you can go from marshes to forest, right?
Yeah.
Which is like really the story of New York as you're describing in this book. So I want to talk about a little sliver of an island in the East River, which I think had some of the most interesting stories. Roosevelt Island, as it's called now, has some of the best views of the Manhattan skyline, I think everyone would agree, of any place in the city.
So for our listeners, Roosevelt Island is between
Queens,
which is the westernmost edge of Long Island, and then there's the East River, and then there's Manhattan Peninsula Island. So this is this little spit of land that's right in the middle of the river.
Yeah, and what I learned from the book is that the land changed hands many times since the Dutch apparently used it as a place to pasture hogs, so it was called Hog Island, right?
Uh-huh.
And it kind of was, because it wasn't connected to the mainland, it was kind of like this land apart, and it had everything on it from lunatic asylums to penitentiaries. But then in the 1960s, something shifted, and it started to be transformed. So I want you to share a little bit about the New York Governor Rockefeller's like vision of what he wanted Roosevelt Island to be and how it was transformed from this sort of hodgepodge of things to the green space and affordable living space that it is now.
Okay, first of all, one slight correction. This was not Nelson Rockefeller's idea.
Okay, corrected. I stand corrected.
Okay, no. What you have was, and you gave a good reprise of the history, it had become called Welfare Island,
right.
because that's when you mentioned the institutions that were put there,
mm-hmm.
Including there were two hospitals, but even earlier, there was the smallpox hospital. There were, you know, very old quarantine facilities for people with contagious diseases. So it was called Welfare Island. And then there was William Vandenhoevel is his name. He was the former ambassador to the United Nations. And back in the time when John Lindsay was mayor, now we're talking the early 1970s.
Right.
And Lindsay, he goes to Lindsay, Bill Vandenhoevel, and he's been a lifelong, deeply admiring follower of FDR.
Okay.
He's a Dutch immigrant. His family came, and the New Deal meant everything to that family. And he had met Eleanor Roosevelt when he was a boy, and so he came up with the suggestion of renaming the island Roosevelt Island. And we mentioned earlier city planning, and so this was going to be, is today, they called it back then the New Town in Town. So it's a planned community that was built for, primarily it was built with funding from the state of New York. It was a, like Battery Park. It was an Urban Development Corporation community. And middle-income apartments designed by really good architects. So they're quite pleasant to live in, and the people who have them really love them, and they love being there in this quiet spot with all these fabulous urban views that you talked about. So then at the same time that it was ready to become a new town, and a lot of those old hospital facilities were being turned into rubble, Bill Vandenhoevel went to the architect Louis Kahn, and the he and the planning authorities here, and so the Roosevelt Memorial was designed. Kahn died in 1973 before it could be built. Bill Vandenhoevel had his Four Freedoms Foundation, and so much of any of these activities to make or preserve green places has to do with what I call the three P's: patience, passion, and persistence.
Okay.
Okay? He, Bill and his cohorts and other people who thought that Louis Kahn was one of the greatest 20th century architects, they kept the fires burning for this ideal of having a wonderful memorial to FDR. So when you go there today, it's the four, and you can go on the tramway or the F train, more subway access, and then you see Four Freedoms Park, and at the very tip, the very end, it's what Kahn called the room, and it's a white cube of marble, and you can, but it's open-sided so that when you look out, there are just magnificent views. You see the United Nations, that of course is symbolically very important, and you also see the great skyline of Manhattan and the Pepsi Cola sign over in Queens. And it's a lovely park, and everyone should go there.
And it's really at the tip of
the southern tip of the island.
The southern tip of the island. So you're in the East River, but right there is also where the Long Island Sound kind of funnels in to
Hellgate.
And it's the it's a very serious sailing situation. The currents there are the most extreme in anywhere
of the harbor.
I believe in the North America, it is the most intense sailing situation because of shoals and because of the land, the topography, and
well,
the currents.
It's infamous that way.
Yeah,
I have never sailed to.
I have some friends that are sailors, and they talk about it, and it's It's just crazy because of the landscape underneath the water and the shoals and the currents, and you've got, you know, you've got big major arteries of water coming through there.
Well, you see, that's another example of what we talked about at the very beginning of this program, which is geology and topography and how all of these waterways and the geological formations, they really, and the Roosevelt Island itself, of course, is a rocky protrusion of the Manhattan Schist. So it's all about the natural history of this place.
We have to take a break. This is a good spot
To pause.
To pause. So stay on the line. You're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network.
Ever wonder where your Christmas tree came from? Now you don't have to. New York State grown Christmas trees are now available in New York City. Trees grown on farms here in New York State are harvested just a few days before arrival to the city. Trees cut close to home stay fresh longer, and trees cut close to home travel less, which reduces fuel consumption of delivery vehicles. Did you know that buying a real tree helps to sustain agriculture in New York State by supporting local farmers and keeping important open space in agriculture production? The Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York is partnering with Grow NYC to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets in Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan. So when you shop local this holiday season, you can include the tree in that list. For more information and a full list of locations, visit ChristmasTreesNY.org.
Hi, welcome back. We today are talking with Betsy Barlow Rogers and her new book, Green Metropolis, about New York green history and park building and open space issues. So before the break, we were talking about Roosevelt Island, and we need to go back to
We'll get back. I want to talk about Central Park.
Central Park.
Because there's a chapter in the book about the ramble, which you call the green heart of Central Park. I don't think people think about it. I think when people think about Central Park, they think about the meadow. They think about
strawberry fields.
Strawberry fields.
Ice skating,
the lake. The ramble is amazing. Tell us about, it was a very interesting story. Tell our listeners about how the ramble got restored and what it's like today.
Why the ramble rambles.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, the ramble is not only the heart of the park, it's very close to my heart. I'm in it almost every day. It's a special spot in Central Park. It's this 30-acre woodland, and it is between the 79th Street Transverse Road, and then it forms, it's, I think you mentioned, or whether you did or not, it's like a peninsular, it has a shoreline of the lake. So the shoreline of the lake opposite the Bethesda Terrace up to the 79th Transverse Road where the Belvedere Castle overlooks. Okay, so here Olmsted and Vox, the designers of Central Park, they wanted to create a very romantic little woodland landscape, and therefore the paths are very circuitous, and even I, who've been in the park many, many, many times, can sometimes get turned around, and it's a pleasant kind of disorientation. So you're meant to be in this part of the park where you're not aware at all of this teeming metropolis.
There is no grid. Right. There is no grid in Central Park.
Well, no, there's no grid in Central Park. It's exempted from the New York City grid, 840 acres, but within the Ramble, there's no grid in the park, period.
Yeah.
But within the Ramble, you have these very windy little paths, and it was created as a woodland. It's planted, of course, because all of Central Park is man-made. Mm-hmm. We mentioned, except for the bones that we mentioned earlier, the big, great rock outcrops. Mm-hmm. All of Central Park is sculpted with topsoil imported and all the trees that are planted. Anyway, the Ramble is a forest in the middle, in the heart of the park. It happens to be a prime stopover for migrating birds on the Atlantic Flyway. Beautiful little warblers in the spring, and all sorts of other birds that are there year-round. Mm-hmm. And then it also is the geological, we always get back to geology here, some of the greatest rock outcrops. They're used intentionally in the design. And so you see these huge, they're more than boulders, they're outcrops. Mm-hmm. And then you see vegetation. Now, vegetation has to, it doesn't last over centuries except for a few, you know, wonderful long surviving trees. So the vegetation palette of the park changed over time. From the time of when it was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted and Calvert Box, that era, it's very romantic era. Remember, it's the period of the Hudson River Valley painters and so forth. Well, it has vines and it has, it's very, very picturesque. Mm-hmm. The planting is intentionally picturesque to look like a piece of the Adirondacks. Mm-hmm. Then you have botanical discoveries that come in. Remember the late 19th, early 20th century, you have before the founding of New York Botanical Garden, Central Park is showcasing some of the rhododendrons, some of the other wonderful exotic plants. Okay, so the character of the Ramble changes. It's not a botanical garden, but it accepts some of these new species, new to cultivation in this country. And then you have that terrible period when the park was just nearly destroyed, and there was no management, and the weeds grew up, including in the Ramble. The most pernicious spreading weed of all is Japanese knotweed called Polygonum cuspidatum.
Yeah,
and that sounds evil.
Didn't it sound good?
We talked about it last week. It's an edible. It's a forage edible. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I've actually had a little, this is off track, but Gary Linkoff, who you know Gary, he's a plant forager, and he says it's like herbal rhubarb. Well, I'm not too sure about that. But anyway, I have tasted it. And so the Japanese knotweed was ubiquitous, and the erosion. So the Central Park Conservancy, our mission was to bring back native plants and what I call in the book, I call it eco-culture, because working with the bird watchers, the bird watching community, which is very proprietary about the Ramble. So all having a woodland management committee made up of people like that and our staff, I'm speaking R because of my long relationship with Central Park, and having a planting that is really promoting the and nourishing wildlife. Dead logs have insects. This is food for birds, berry-producing plants, but mostly all natives.
The forest floor, right.
Yeah. But first, eliminating the knotweed.
Yeah.
And that's been done over time, and it's still, you know, it's always ongoing, but most of it is gone now, and what you see is a beautiful forest floor. And you do see some of the remaining exotic plants, which are kind of wonderful. see how it's a park is. I like to call it sometimes a palimpsest because you have all these different layers, and you can read the old layers even as you are planting the new ones.
Yeah, absolutely. So whenever visitors come to New York, I always point them, if they've never been to the city, I point them to the Manhattan website, because you can go to the Manhattan website and you can see what New York looked like 400 years ago when Henry Hudson sailed up the Hudson River. Let's talk about Staten Island and what he first would have seen coming up into the harbor. He would have seen so much beautiful greenery. And then we go, you know, into civilization building, right? And now let's return to talking about the forest floor and rebuilding on junk, right? Let's talk about fresh kills.
Yes, on Staten Island.
On Staten Island, because you can't ignore this amazing new project that is not yet open to the public. Can you tell our listeners about this project?
It won't be open probably for 30 years.
Yeah.
And when we talk about building a park there, it's hardly the right word. It is letting nature be your partner in creating a park over time. Now, the chapter in my book on Fresh Kills Park is really the story of garbage.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because when we think of the wetlands of New York City, you have to think of this. Think of the location with all of the water bodies. Think of Pelham Bay with Long Island Sound. Mm-hmm. Think of Queens where the World's Fair was built. Mm-hmm. Now the
where LaGuardia
Flushing
is.
Meadow,
right.
Flushing Meadow Park,
uh-huh,
next to LaGuardia. So all of these wetlands progressively were gobbled up by garbage. Where were they going to put all this garbage? Mm-hmm. They put it in the wetlands, mm-hmm, and then later capped the wetlands. We talked earlier about Robert Moses on some of these decommissioned wetlands. He built golf courses, as in Marine Park,
uh-huh,
and other places. So there is this whole history of smothering our wetlands, the last one being Fresh Kills, the last and the largest, which was decommissioned in the year, I think, 2000, and then it did have to open to accept the debris from the 9/11.
Right, yes. Yeah, right. For a short time. Right.
Yes, the debris from the two towers.
Right.
But it's closed. And they being the City Planning Commission, they held a design competition. And the idea is, of course, that the sanitation department, mm-hmm, that had managed it as a garbage dump,
to, right,
was going to turn it over to the Parks Department.
Again, a scuffle with the sanitation department.
Yes. Right.
Well, this wasn't such a scuffle.
No, I'm teasing.
This was
right.
To really plan. This
yes.
was a planned
yes.
transfer.
Right.
And Robert Moses was out of the picture by this
right.
time.
So there
because
was no
he
scuffle.
Would have built it,
right.
put recreation facilities on it.
Mm-hmm.
So the competition was won by Field Operations, that landscape firm run by James Corner.
Mm-hmm.
And the ideal is to let the capped mounds, there are four major mounds, revegetate themselves with a little encouragement from the park department
right.
managers.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't allow the public in until all of the methane gases have been emitted. So what you see there, you see the grass is beginning to take hold. It's so wonderful to see mm-hmm. nature taking its course and things that happen as they did on the High Line, where before it became even more so, the beautiful vegetation of a ruin, industrial ruin, and in this case an old garbage dump.
Mm-hmm.
So you see that happening, but you also see these pipes coming out of the ground
yeah.
that are releasing the methane. Some of it is being piped into a plant where it's produced, energy is produced and distributed. But that park is a park in the making. You can go once a year for a sneak peek.
I want to do one of
those.
Yeah,
we wanted to do that. And it's, I mean, just to give people a sense of scale, how much bigger is it than Central Park?
Well, Central Park is 843 acres, and Fresh Kills is 2,400, I believe.
Right. It really is the whole tip of the island.
So, and growing up on Staten Island, you could smell the dump.
Yeah.
Every day on some hot days.
Yeah.
So I think what's interesting for me as a New Yorker is, besides potentially getting, maybe in my lifetime, a new giant park or green space, just the fact that it's Staten Island especially, which didn't seem to have a plan at all whatsoever in its development. I have to say, it just seemed hodgepodge. It's really great to see that some really progressive stuff is happening there. That the park, even the way that the park is being made, you described in the book that it's being not made or built, but grown, right? Using farming techniques. You know, they're planting, I think, some edibles, right? Certain kinds of farm crops.
Well, they're sheep.
Well, no, but I think that's a vision that's in the plan.
In the plan, okay.
In the plan. That's a vision that's in the design competition winning plan by field operations.
So ultimately they would plant edibles that would then be turned over and then feed the soil, and it would be...
Right.
And to me it's awesome because Staten Island was... farms.
Well, here's really
Thoreau was writing about nature on Staten Island.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. He was there for a brief period of time. Staten Island is a wonderful place, but to wind up our discussion of Fresh Kills, there's a lot of phragmites. Wherever you have a disturbed landscape, you know, phragmites comes in the damper areas.
Right.
Okay. So there's just a lot of phragmites. Mm-hmm. Now, what is the technique for getting rid of phragmites?
I know this.
Grazing goats.
Yes. Right.
And you know this.
Yes.
You know a lot. You want to say how the goats are shipped in periodically. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say.
Tell that part of the story.
In Prospect Park, which is my basic backyard, they have now imported goats. And they are now, and they are doing remediation with goats.
Poison ivy. Yeah.
And also phragmites. And it's been so successful that they are now renting the goats out to other parks. That's why I know about Staten Island. So
this is so great.
Yeah. And they also do, you know, they do that plastic, that black plastic, and they cover the entire area to keep the, you know, to keep it from spreading.
I didn't know that goats loved phragmites.
Well, I didn't either until I went to Fresh Kills. And I don't think that sheep do, but, I mean, think of the sheep meadow in Central Park. We once had sheep, and you had sheep in Brooklyn in Prospect Park.
Mm-hmm.
But now you have goats.
Now we have goats. Well, Betsy, you, I mean, you got started in this environmental movement in the late 60s, right? Mid to late 60s. I was born in 68. I remember in Washington, D.C., hearing bits and pieces about it. It sparked my interest. I remember Mount Trashmore in Virginia Beach, which was really the first of those garbage heap parks. My brother was a big skateboarder, and they turned Mount Trashmore into a skate park. And it still is one of the great skate parks along the Eastern Seaboard. And it's all because of the work that you have done and been involved with that these projects exist. And you've really made the city a much better place. And thank you for all of your work and your books to teach people about it. It really is important.
Get Green Metropolis. It's a great book. I highly recommend it. I read it from cover to cover.
Buy it. It's a great present for your friends.
It's a lyrical book. You know, whether you are a New Yorker or not a New Yorker, you want to know really what New York is about.
Yeah.
This is it.
Well, and it also, you know, like Betsy said, it starts with geology and it starts with an understanding and an appreciation of how land is used. And, you know, I think we all have a responsibility to understand the history of it and to act as stewards for the future.
Thank you for letting me talk about my favorite subject.
And what is your website?
My website is foundationforlandscapestudies.org.
Okay. And then you have a personal website, too.
I do, and it's my name, Elizabeth Barlow Rogers at... No, that's my email, ElizabethBarlowRogers.com.
Thank you. Good.
Well, the show has been written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Krieg. Please remember to check out our new website, WeDigPlantsPodcast.com, or follow us on Twitter. There's other people to follow on Twitter besides you-know-who. You can follow us at WeDigPlants to stay current on our projects and upcoming shows, or follow us on Instagram at GroundworksGardensNYC. Thanks for listening.
See you in the virtual garden.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.